We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, hour number two of our program. This is our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. And we're also pleased to have back on the program once again with us, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And every other month, he is here with us for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. The idea is, a long time ago, we thought it would be a good opportunity to have a regular show here with somebody who could respond to a wide range of questions. We do occasionally on the program have specialists who deal with particular parts of the body. But he is a guy, Dr. Jeff is a guy who's got to deal with the whole thing. And he sees people of all ages in his practice. So I'm sure he'll do his best to help you out and answer your questions. So it could be for you, could be for someone in your family. Give us a call. And as long as people keep in mind we can't do diagnosis over the phone, we'll do great. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Glad to be here.
We have somebody ready to go, so we will not make them wait. We'll go right to them, and this is a caller in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being on the air. I have two related symptoms, and I am looking for some insights into ways I might be proactive with my own physician, who I saw twice last week. I'm a senior citizen, and I have a low white count and a low red count for which no cause has been found, although they haven't looked very hard. And then 2.5 weeks ago, I came down with this dreadful flu, which I cannot shake, and I cannot make my temperature stay at a regular pace. It goes up and down like a yo-yo. And so I wondered, are there any things I might... Oh, I have one other question before I ask a general one. Can somebody do a swab of the sinuses the way one does a swab of a throat?
Well, let's start with your last question first. The answer is basically no. The only way to swab the sinuses would be during a surgical procedure where an ear, nose, and throat person would be able to open up the sinus and get inside it. So essentially, no. The specifics of the bacteria that are contained in the sinuses are generally thought to be similar to the respiratory viruses and bacterial infections that do afflict the most of the respiratory tract, but there isn't any specific way to culture the sinus without actually surgically getting in there.
And then about 6 months ago, I heard all kinds of news stories about how dangerous staph infection is. It can cause warts on the hand, or it can be internal. And how does one ask for a test on a staph infection? Is that something that is done through blood work? I'll listen.
Okay. The vast majority of staph infections occur typically on the skin as either a localized infection, what people would think of as a boil, or sometimes something that involves a wider distribution on the skin, often referred to as cellulitis. The reason staph has gotten so much attention recently is that a particular form of the staph bacteria called methicillin-resistant staph aureus is just that. It's resistant to methicillin or other types of penicillins, which typically have been used to treat staph infections. So if you have what is commonly referred to as MRSA, which is the abbreviation MRSA, the typical penicillin-type antibiotics don't work. The only way to identify whether a particular infection is this is to get a sample of it. Since staph is typically on the skin, in those instances, you are able to take a swab of, say, a boil or an open sore and determine what type of bacteria is present. This particular infection can also be quite serious if it gets into the bloodstream, because then it obviously can go anywhere in the body. And because it is resistant to so many antibiotics, it becomes quite difficult to treat.
Are there any things that I might suggest to my doctor that he look at? And he's a very competent doctor. I really find my adult medicine doctor just to be smart and very with it. Are there things that I could suggest that he might explore?
Relative to your first two concerns regarding the changes in your blood count and your flu-like symptoms, those could, in fact, potentially be related. We know that viral infections themselves can cause changes in your blood count. So this may simply be something that's occurring right now. If these turn out to be separate issues, most flu-like symptoms are, in fact, self-limited and should resolve within a couple of weeks. If your blood count goes back to being normal, it may be assumed that the abnormalities were related to the infection. If they do not go back to normal, then some additional laboratory studies, usually some additional blood work, and in some instances, what's called a bone marrow test.
I have had. My doctor referred me to a hematologist who did a bone marrow test and indeed found that the bone marrow cells were not putting out the most complete platelets.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, you know, I do have a low white count and a low red count. And but what kind of other tests might I ask for other than the bone marrow test, which has already been done?
That would probably be considered the definitive test in this particular situation. Whether it will need to be repeated down the line will simply be dependent on what your blood count does. Again, if you have a self-limited condition with no specific abnormalities noted in the bone marrow, there's a good chance that things will resolve. If, on the other hand, it's persistent, it's possible that the bone marrow was simply obtained at a time when it was too early to detect any other changes going on. So that may be something that needs to be repeated. But the bone marrow would be considered the definitive test for answering your questions regarding your blood count.
And what might I suggest to my doctor to help me get rid of these flu symptoms, which are just knocking me out?
Again, in terms of a viral infection, these symptoms should, in fact, be self-limited over the course of a few weeks, other than addressing the issues of fever with medications to bring your temperature back to normal. There isn't any specific treatment.
No specific blood tests that I could suggest to my doctor.
No.
And is 2.5 weeks considered normal for a flu that won't go away with fever? Or should I wait another week and, you know, make another appointment to see him?
I think you're still well within the time frame that we could expect a viral process to be operating. So given the studies that you've already had done and the fact that they've been pretty reassuring, no, I don't think there's any problem with you waiting and following up with your physician another week.
Okay. Thank you very much for your information. It's very appreciated.
You're welcome. Thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome here. We're talking with Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic, and he is here on the program every other month, always on a Monday, for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. So it's your opportunity. If you have some concerns about your health or member of your family, you can call and talk with Dr. Jeff, and he will see if he can help you out. I want to spend some time here talking about influenza. The CDC continues to recommend that people have the vaccine, one or both vaccines for seasonal flu or H1N1. Just as far as H1N1 is concerned, it seems to me that it wasn't all that long ago, maybe at least within a month or two, where it seemed that I was continuing to hear some questions, people asking some questions, even people in the medical community asking questions about how serious H1N1 would turn out to be and whether or not CDC perhaps was going a little overboard in the way that they were talking about it. So right now, what can we say about H1N1 and how big a problem do you think it's likely to be?
How big a problem it's likely to be, I think, will depend on how successful the immunization program will be. The virus itself is distinctly different from the seasonal flu viruses, which is why the immunization for the seasonal flu will not necessarily protect you against the H1N1, and consequently you need to get a separate vaccination for H1N1. H1N1 does not seem to be particularly more virulent than the regular seasonal flu, but it does seem to target a different patient population. In particular, younger people seem to be more adversely affected, and there's a higher death rate in otherwise younger, healthier people with H1N1 compared to the seasonal flu. And this is concerning in that the sort of reservoir for the flu viruses is typically in younger individuals. So the school-age children and young adults are very commonly carriers of influenza. They, with the seasonal flu, typically will survive that. They don't seem to be doing quite as well with the H1N1. Even if it's not as virulent as the seasonal flu, one still needs to remember that the regular seasonal flu kills probably 35,000 people a year in the United States. And this is a substantial number. The vast majority of those individuals are the very young, the very old, or individuals who have significant other medical conditions that basically weaken their immune system. As I mentioned, the H1N1 seems to be a little different in that there seems to be a higher mortality rate in otherwise younger, healthier people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that I think there you put your finger on what is a concern about H1N1 is that certain people are vulnerable, and I think there's particular concern about the pediatric population, and for that reason, it's recommended that that young children, and I guess probably anyone up to their like early to mid-20s, I think.
Correct.
It is recommended that those people be vaccinated. And then also for the people in the older age range.
The older age range definitely needs to get their regular seasonal flu immunization. They're probably going to actually be on the bottom end of the priority list for H1N1.
Okay.
One additional group that is commonly overlooked are pregnant patients. And there is a very strong recommendation from the CDC for pregnant patients to be immunized not only against the seasonal influenza, but H1N1 as well.
Yeah. I think there is some concern among doctors that some number of parents, and I guess I don't know exactly what that number is, but some number of parents apparently are hesitant to have their children vaccinated against the H1N1 flu. And I guess there's some, I don't know if that's a general hesitance about vaccinations or it has something to do with the fact that this is new and they're wondering, well, how thoroughly have we tested this? How many people have gotten it? Can we be sure that there won't be bad side effects? What would you say to a parent of a young child who was wavering about whether or not they should have their child vaccinated?
I think this is an issue that, as you mentioned, transcends just influenza, but goes into the whole general concept of the safety of immunizations. And to the best of our knowledge right now, there really isn't anything different about the H1N1 vaccination. It was produced in the same manner as the regular seasonal flu vaccination. So there really isn't anything different about how it was produced, and consequently the side effects or potential complications really aren't any different than the regular seasonal flu vaccination, which is also recommended for children as well. Mm-hmm. So if you were normally going to immunize your child against influenza, which is a good idea, adding the H1N1 is not any additional burden or risk to the individual. And the vaccinations themselves are very, very safe because the flu shots are basically given to individuals with killed virus particles and not even complete viral particles. So there isn't any way for anyone to get influenza from a flu shot. So you frequently hear people who say, oh, well, you know, I got the flu after I got my flu shot. You know, people need to remember that it will take a week or two for their immunity to respond to their flu shot, and if they had been exposed to influenza around the time of their flu shot, they may still get influenza. Mm-hmm. But typically the most common side effects or reactions to the shot is basically just a little redness or a sore arm.
I have some callers we'll get to right in a second. I just want to ask one more quick thing. When we first started talking about H1N1, there was some question about how many doses would be necessary to get the immune response. So would one shot do it, or would we have to have two?
Interestingly, the studies done with H1N1 have shown a very good response to a single vaccination, which is actually somewhat unusual. In many instances, when being immunized against something new, you oftentimes do need one, two, sometimes three vaccinations. If you think of the childhood vaccinations, you get your diphtheria and your pertussis and tetanus repeatedly to build up immunity over time. But the most recent study done with the H1N1 vaccine showed a very brisk and actually early response in terms of immunity after a single shot. So it's hoped that just one will be necessary.
Okay. We have a couple of callers here. They're both in Champaign. We'll start with line one.
Hello?
Yes. Go ahead.
There. I'm one of the perhaps, I don't know, 40-something million people without health insurance. So this is a good resource for us before we go and spend the money to go to the hospital. I've been having a respiratory infection at a varying level for about 2 months. It's been fairly low level. I've been fairly functional, varying degrees of runny nose and varying degrees of chest congestion, coughing up mucus that has ranged from clear to yellow to green, and then as I would get better again, back to clear again, and then I've gone through this cycle, like say twice in 2 months, lost my voice and just regained it. And the reason I've been hesitant to go to a doctor is that in the past, I go in there, you know, it's this quick 5-minute meeting where they basically prescribe me antibiotics and don't tell me anything that I don't already know. And I've had had a bad experience when I was younger being overprescribed antibiotics over and over again for a condition that just kept reoccurring until I quit taking the antibiotics and battled it on my own, diet and behavior, that sort of thing.
And your question is?
I'm just wondering, how, what advice you would give to someone in that kind of situation. I'm now, after 2 months, thinking, well, gee, I should probably go to a doctor. But, is there a way to confirm that you need antibiotics before they're given to you? Are there other causes that usually I heal fairly quickly? I treat myself really well. I don't smoke, that sort of thing.
Okay. It's good to hear that you don't smoke. That's probably one of the key factors in determining whether a respiratory infection may be a more serious problem. Have your symptoms been present continuously over 2 months, or they've come and gone?
They've mostly come and gone, but even when they were gone, there was kind of like a dry, almost wheeziness, or not exactly asthma, but like an itchiness in my lungs, the back of my throat. Makes me wonder if I have some allergy that has never affected me to this degree before.
Right. And some of what you've described is consistent with either a viral infection that unfortunately can be, in fact, recurrent, because if you get re-exposed to it, you can get the symptoms again. Or at this time of year, seasonal allergies are, in fact, quite common in the runny nose and the congestion and the itchy kind of sensation and the congestion in the chest are frequently seen individuals with allergic responses. The typical treatment for a viral respiratory infection, again, is just symptomatic, something for temperature, plenty of fluids to keep mucus thin and moving, rest. We become concerned if somebody says, I had what I thought was, a cold or a little viral bronchitis, but now, I'm really sick. I have a temperature of 104. I have chest pain. I have difficulty breathing. I'm coughing up stuff, with blood in it. We know in a small percentage of cases that some people will, in fact, go on to develop pneumonia. But they're going to pretty much know it because they're going to be significantly sicker than they were before. If your symptoms tend to come and go, again, either recurrent viral infections or potentially allergic symptoms, with the possibility of allergies, the addition of a little over-the-counter antihistamine would not be an unreasonable thing to try to minimize your symptoms. The presence of, you mentioned voice loss, is not commonly seen with bacterial infections. It's much more commonly due to irritation from viral infections or postnasal drip from allergies. So what you've described does not sound particularly like a condition that would automatically warrant antibiotics. Obviously, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, it's not possible to examine you, so I obviously have no idea what your lungs sound like or perhaps what a chest x-ray looks like. But what you're describing so far does not sound particularly like a situation that would warrant antibiotics.
I went to a free clinic in Champaign about a month and a half ago, and the doctor that I saw there said that she thought I either had a viral bronchitis or a walking pneumonia, and she gave me a prescription for antibiotics at the time, but wasn't sure that I needed them, and they don't have the budget to do a test to determine if there was a bacterial infection. Is it generally possible to discover that it is a bacterial infection before taking antibiotics, or are there so many different varieties of bacteria that it's hard to pinpoint that it...
There are some specific types of bacterial infections predominantly related to pneumonia that can, in fact, be tested for. You mentioned one, mycoplasma, which commonly produces what people refer to as walking pneumonia. Pneumococcal pneumonia is usually something where people are really, really sick, oftentimes may end up in the hospital. Legionella, people may be familiar with Legionnaire's disease is another form of pneumonia that can be tested for. But there are certainly a number of other things that cannot specifically be identified. In many instances, if it's of a significant concern, you can do blood work, looking at the white blood cell count. Some changes there may indicate bacterial versus viral infections. You may do the tests for specific types of pneumonia, and you may also do a chest x-ray looking for the signs of pneumonia on the chest x-ray itself, in addition to the physical findings of the lung. So in answer to whether you need antibiotics, those would be the additional tests that would normally be done to try and sort out a serious bacterial infection in the lung from all other respiratory conditions.
But every one of those is probably expensive, I'd imagine.
On the medical scale, they're relatively inexpensive, but you're quite correct. There doesn't seem to be anything in the medical world that's inexpensive.
I developed a rather severe bronchitis when I was in Thailand earlier this year during a period when they do slash and burn in the north of Thailand, and you can breathe in a lot of particulate matter that you can see in the air. But the reason I'd gone there initially was to get MRIs done and also to have just to be checked up because I haven't seen a doctor in years. And I managed to, for a few $100s, get what would have here cost maybe $15,000 because I added up the costs of these many things. I was pretty amazed. These people were fluent in English, and they had the time to have a like real conversation and a focused analysis. And I learned more in 2 days than I did in 8 years of going through with full university insurance at Carl Hospital.
Mm-hmm. There is no question that in many instances overseas, the costs of medical care compared to the United States are significantly lower.
Thank you very much for your time.
I thank the call. We'll go on here to somebody else. This is line number two, also somebody in Champaign. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. It's a good afternoon? Almost.
Close.
Hi. Yeah, this is Christine from Champaign. And everything the man said prior to my speaking is about the conditions that I have. And it seems like this is a theme going on today. However, I would like to add that I have reoccurring tonsillitis. I still have my tonsils, so I get the white spots. You know, they're all ulcerated and that. And I've had earaches, which, by the way, I don't know if you ever heard this, but if you squeeze some raw onion and get the juice and put that in your ear, warm it up, put in your... It really works for earaches. I didn't know where I heard that from, but it does work. My question is, after you spoke about all these other things and gave some good advice, what about the probiotics for helping the post-nasal drip? Because I suffer from that a lot, taking yogurt with the acidophilus, and what else can you suggest?
The probiotics, I think, are... definitely a reasonable thing to do in situations where people are on especially broad-spectrum antibiotics for a period of time, because there's no question that in addition to killing off the bad bacteria, you can, in fact, kill off some of the good bacteria that we need in our system. So in that particular setting, I think the use of the probiotics to help offset the adverse effects of antibiotic usage is a reasonable thing. But otherwise, I'm not particularly aware of any studies that suggest by themselves that they're going to make a lot of difference in terms of your overall sinus condition.
So the probiotics, my question, I guess, is I know you could get like an acidophilus. I'm not taking any antibiotic, and I really don't plan to. But it is annoying to constantly get the sore throat and, you know, like the man prior said, you know, losing your voice and itchy eyes and the tonsillitis and that. What can I take? What can I boost my immune system, I guess? Is there something that I could do to, like, they have those little pots you could buy at the drugstore to rinse your sinuses out and... What's, have any ideas on that?
Yeah, what's referred to as a neti pot is basically it's a sinus irrigation system to sort of mechanically basically wash out the nasal passages and part of the sinuses. And for individuals who can use it, there are just a number of people who just don't tolerate things up their nose. But for individuals who can use it, I've had a number of folks tell me that it's been very, very helpful. And primarily what you're doing is just not allowing mucus to accumulate in the sinuses, where, in fact, you can then get bacterial overgrowth. So in many instances, if you can mechanically flush out the nose and the sinuses, that's often very, very helpful in terms of preventing recurrent sinus infections and can also minimize the amount of congestion that people feel.
Doctor, do you feel that when you're talking about bacteria in the sinuses, are you talking about a fungal infection? Is there, I mean, because I've read some things on saying that this is a fungus or mold that's causing this, because I do work outside a lot, and I work in the compost, and of course, and I wear gloves and all that, and I'm working with organic soil and that. Would that be part of my problem?
It would be very unusual to have a fungal or mold-type infection in the sinuses in someone who otherwise doesn't have an underlying immune problem. The body does not commonly tolerate fungal infections. It's very, very unusual to see that as a primary problem in the sinuses in the absence of some other immune system problem, because usually the body is very, very good at getting rid of that. It's only in under very unusual set of circumstances would we commonly expect to see a fungal infection.
Would a fungal infection or some type of you know, like the T cells, how they fight the good cells. I do have fibromyalgia and other issues going on with me, so I don't know if that gives me a suppressed immune system.
I'm specifically not aware of any studies between the immune system and fibromyalgia. I'm sorry, I'm
that's okay.
Not drawing any relevant information on that subject.
Well, okay, thank you for the information. Is there something, I mean, can you give me some hope on something outside of using the neti pot and just...
For seasonal allergy symptoms, some of which, your symptoms are consistent with, the most standard recommendation is going to be avoid anything that you think you can avoid that might be triggering symptoms. Try and block the allergic response with an antihistamine. And then if need be, you can ramp up the additional types of allergy medications. There are very commonly used steroid nasal sprays, and in really stubborn cases, allergy injections over a long time can be helpful for people with stubborn allergies. But mechanically keeping the nose and sinuses rinsed is a very safe and really no medication side effects related to it way of treating sinus congestion.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Seems like everybody's having these problems right now. I really appreciate your added advice. Thank you.
We are a bit past the midpoint here. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here on the show every other month for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor, so your questions are welcome. Has this been a particularly bad year for seasonal allergies, particularly those that come at the end of the summer?
I don't think it's necessarily been any worse than usual. It's just that this particular time of year is, in fact, usually pretty bad for people with seasonal allergies. It really takes a good killing frost to get the plant material that triggers a lot of the allergy responses to go away. The other thing that goes on this particular time of year, which sometimes is allergic and sometimes is just irritating, is the amount of agricultural dust that gets tossed up into the atmosphere. And so between allergens and irritants, this is actually a fairly common time for people to have sort of upper respiratory symptoms.
All right. On to Champaign County. Line 3, hello.
Hi, I was going to ask a general question, and I don't know if you really need to be an epidemiologist to treat it, but maybe I'll just ask for your opinion. And the thing about the H1N1 is the same thing as what people were worried about with the bird flu, which is an increase in virulence, right? That something might change somewhere in the world and it might spread. So that the idea is to vaccinate, or I guess there was some talk about swine flu parties where people were purposefully exposing themselves, so that the theory there being that, you know, it's like a vaccine, it's not as pleasant, but you'd be getting it now rather than later.
You are correct. The virus that causes influenza constantly shifts, and that's why the flu shots that are normally given seasonally have to be adjusted to make sure that it covers the more common strains that are expected to be circulating in the population. But you mentioned virulence, and that too can shift within a particular virus. Something that wasn't necessarily all that fatal can, in fact, become that. And so one of the hopes of vaccination is that if you get vaccinated against the less virulent, at least we think less virulent, H1N1 now, you may at least develop some immunity that would be helpful should you become exposed later to a variant of that virus that is more virulent.
Yeah, just generally about public health, I just heard a very scary statistic, which is that in the last year, 10,000 public health workers have been laid off because of budget cuts around the state, the states, and it's if there was a shift of virulence, that would be seen as a real disaster. I think that, I mean, not just the virulence itself, but the fact that the downsizing has been so bad. I don't know what percentage that is. I don't know. I do have a personal question too, and I'm taking Keflex right now. Could you just? I've gone to a couple of sites to investigate it and read the usual brochure, but I'm taking probiotics, but if you have any personal insight or experience on that particular antibiotic,
and it's being prescribed for.
I have a kind of a surface infection, just a skin infection of sorts. Too autobiographical, right? But thanks a lot. I'll listen.
Okay. Keflex is a brand name for a very commonly prescribed antibiotic known as cefalexin. It is very commonly used because it is generally very well-tolerated medication, has a fairly broad spectrum against the common bacterial infections that people tend to get. In terms of skin infections, the one particular concern, as we alluded to earlier in the program, is to make sure that you don't have MRSA, because Keflex then would not be effective against that. So if at all, if there's any question as to whether a particular antibiotic is going to work against a skin-related infection, in an ideal situation, you'd get a sample of that skin infection, send it to the lab, identify the bacteria. The lab then will do what are called sensitivities. They'll basically test that bacteria against a series of antibiotics to see which ones are most effective. And in that particular case, if in fact cefalexin is found to be a reasonable medication for the infection, it's generally a very well-tolerated medication. Had been around for a long time, used very, very successfully, can have the same potential side effects of any antibiotic, which is that if you disturb the normal bacteria in the body, you can potentially have side effects related to that.
Okay. About 10 minutes left here. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice physician at Carl Clinic and is here for the show. We do every other month. We call Talk to the Family Doctor. And if you have questions, I know he'll do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Because we now have the need for the seasonal flu vaccine and the H1N1, I think the vaccine manufacturers are having a tough time meeting demand. So, for example, here in our community, I think the various clinics started to offer seasonal flu shots.
Correct.
And then said, wait a minute, we don't have enough, or we're not sure we have enough. And I guess as far as that's concerned about the seasonal flu, do you think eventually there'll be enough in a timely manner so that people who want the seasonal flu shot can get it?
Yes, that really shouldn't be a long-term problem. The immunization programs actually are gearing up a little earlier than they have in the past. Mm-hmm. Typically, it was more toward the end of October. People are trying to gear up earlier by starting in the beginning of October. I think part of that is to try and get as many people the seasonal flu shot, and then when the H1N1 vaccine becomes available, start that one. There actually isn't any reason why you can't get both at the same time, but it's going to take a lot of people and a lot of facilities and a lot of vaccine to get everybody both shots. So they basically were starting earlier this year than in the past. But I think if the typical production continues, there shouldn't be any problem with everybody who wants to get a seasonal flu shot getting one.
Okay. And you mentioned the fact that when do you get the seasonal flu shot, it does take maybe 1 or 2 weeks.
It can take
for the
a couple weeks
to develop.
That's correct.
So given that, as long as, say, you get your shot by, Thanksgiving, is that timely enough, or should you think about trying to, as soon as you really think that you can get it, should you say, okay,
yes,
I'm going to go?
I think if the vaccine's available and they don't have any reason not to get it, they should go ahead and get it. For people who have, for whatever reason, not gotten it, as long as you haven't gotten the flu yet, you can still get your flu shot anytime during the flu season. So we will actually, catch stragglers in the office in December and January and February who haven't gotten it by then. So it's simply a question of how active the virus is in the community and what your own particular risks are for developing the infection. But the best way to minimize that is to get it as soon as you can. Mm.
As far as H1N1 is concerned, again, I think some of the things that I've read suggest that the people who seem to be the most interested in getting the vaccine, at least the people who say, you ask them, if you could get it, would you? They'd say, yeah, sure, I'm going to get it, are the people who are probably on the lower end of the list of risk.
Right. I think many of the folks 65 and up or folks who have otherwise in the past been targeted as, the high-risk candidates for seasonal flu, I think they've basically gotten the message. And then they understand the value of being immunized against it, so they're all in favor of getting the H1N1. But in fact, they're probably going to turn out to be a little lower priority for that particular vaccine.
Well, if this is maybe an extreme hypothetical, but supposing we get to the point where pretty much we think that all of the people who should get the H1N1 and want to get the H1N1 vaccine have gotten it, and we got some H1N1 left over. If, say, you're not in the high-risk group, but you just, you don't want to get sick, and you could get the shot, would you at that point say to somebody, well, okay, if you want to get the shot, we've got it, sure, roll up your sleeve.
Yes, exactly right.
Okay, but then you would really want to do everything that you could to make sure that you worked your way through the kids and the pregnant women and the people who have the pre-existing conditions and all of those people who truly are on
the higher risk. Right,
okay.
And that may turn out to be one of the benefits of the recent studies that suggested that you may only need one H1 vaccination. because obviously if you needed two, then you need twice as much vaccine supply to immunize everybody. So it's hoped that if a single vaccination is all that's necessary, that there should be plenty of vaccine available for everybody.
Okay. We have about 4 or 5 minutes left here, and I think maybe we're getting another caller lined up. So let us talk with them and someone in Decatur, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I have a quick question. If a number of people get vaccinated for the H1N1 swine flu, does it make any sense? I mean, shouldn't that reduce the viability and the spread? So you probably wouldn't have, let's say, 70% of the people get vaccinated, and wouldn't that cut down on the virulence and minimize your chances of getting it without the vaccine?
It would not reduce the virulence. That's inherent in the virus itself. But in terms of the spread, yes, it would significantly reduce that. And what you're alluding to is what the veterinarians refer to as herd immunity. They basically found that if you immunize 75 to 80% of the herd, that in most instances, the unimmunized member of the herd was surrounded by individuals who've been immunized. So there really wasn't any opportunity for them to garner the infection. And so if you, in fact, you can get a critical mass of the population immunized and assuming sort of random distribution of the unimmunized, those unimmunized individuals are actually benefiting from the fact that everybody around them has, in fact, been immunized. The problem is that in many instances, it's not a random distribution, and consequently, you'll find, some particular group of people who, for whatever reason, decide not to be immunized. If there's a large group of them and the virus gets into that population, it will spread very, very rapidly within that population. But if you have a large segment of the population that is immunized, you do, in fact, significantly reduce its ability to migrate from individual to individual.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Another caller here, Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hi. Just a quick question about the vaccine for pneumonia. How advisable is that for folks over 65, and how many shots should one have of that during a lifetime? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
I think that's an excellent question because in addition to the flu shot, which needs to be done seasonally, there are, in fact, additional immunizations that adults need to periodically get. Everybody knows that kids get immunized to be able to go to school, but adults frequently forget that they, too, periodically need to be immunized. People remember their diphtheria tetanus booster needs to be updated about every 10 years for basically those, you know, bad cuts or the dog bite or when you step on the rusty nail. You don't want to get tetanus. There is a current recommendation to also, at the time that somebody gets their tetanus booster, to also immunize adults against pertussis, which is the whooping cough. That particular vaccination is given in childhood, but the immunity does, in fact, wane, and it's recommended that at least once adults get a booster on their pertussis, and it can often be given along with their tetanus booster. When we hit age 60, there is currently a vaccination available against shingles, which is reactivation of the chickenpox virus in the body. And so individuals over the age of 60 can, in fact, be re-immunized against the chickenpox virus so that they don't come down with shingles. And then we get to age 65, where there is a basic blanket recommendation for folks over 65 to get an annual flu shot, and they should get a pneumonia vaccination at least once after the age of 65. Now, if somebody has underlying conditions where they may, in fact, be more susceptible to pneumonia, there are some recommendations, and they're various between 5 and 10 years that might need to be boosted. But at least once after the age of 65, a pneumonia vaccination is a standard recommendation.
Okay, we'll try to see if we get quickly one more. Champagne, line three. Hello.
Hi. I have a question about the symptoms associated with H1N1, if they look very different from the flu.
They do not.
Okay.
So the only way to tell actually if one had the H1 is to, you can do some kind of test, right?
You can do some sort of testing. There are no current recommendations to do that testing unless an individual is sick enough to end up in the hospital.
Okay. And I have a second general question about family practice versus pediatrician.
Mm-hmm.
Differences, similarities, pros and cons. I'm interested in switching to a family practice doctor for my daughter and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And just wanted to know more information about what to expect.
I think that's probably going to depend on the individual physician, but family medicine physicians spend 3 years after medical school in a residency program in a supervised setting, both in the office and the hospital. And the idea behind family medicine is, as it sounds, is to be able to take care of individuals from pretty much cradle to grave. The statistics that have been generated from looking at residencies and subsequent practices is that about 80% of the medical conditions that people commonly go to their physician for should be able to be handled by their regular family doctor. And that's true for both kids and adults. So I think in many instances, it's really a matter of your personal preferences. Many people find it very convenient to have everybody in the family going to see the same physician. In other instances, people simply like the particular physician that, you know, looks after their kids, and, you know, if they do, that's fine.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, there, we'll have to stop for this time around with our thanks to Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carl Clinic in Urbana, and he is with us every other month on a Monday with a show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. So thanks very much.
Thank you, David. My pleasure.
All right. This program, Focus 580, in fact, support for all of the broadcast today, comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy at Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana. A zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future environment. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910. Programs on WILL also made possible by the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the incomparable Marvin Hamlisch and Michael Feinstein on October 25th. More information on this event is at krannertcenter.com. And that's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about elephants and their emotional lives. Our guest will be Gay Bradshaw, author of Elephants on the Edge. Let's turn our attention now to commodity prices in Kansas City. December wheat is trading at $5.15. That's up 15.5. March 5.16, up 15. Chicago December wheat, 483.5, up 15.5. March, 502.75, up 15.25. December corn, 374.25, up 12. March, 386, up 11.5. May, 394, up 11. July, $4.75. That is up 10.25. November beans, 989.75, up 25.75. January, 990.75, up 23.75. March, 988.75, up 20.75. May, 982.5, up 18. July, 982, up 18.25. October meal, 319 even, up 870. October oil, 35.71, up 80. October live cattle, 82.32.5, down 30. December, 85.32.5, up 37.5. October feeder cattle, 94 even, down 17.5. November, 94.15, down 32.5. And October lean hogs, 50.30, down 55. Outside markets, November crude, 71.77, up 8. The U.S. dollar, 76.10, down 33. The CRB index, 265.80, up 325. On Wall Street, the